Welcome to Measure to Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who use them, and the people who built them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, who built it, when it was built, why it was built, how it was built.
That's it.
That's it. That's what we're going to tell you.
There you go. Let's get into it. This episode, we're going to talk about the Kowloon Walled City.
Okay.
So the Kowloon Walled City was a settlement that was within the island of Hong Kong.
Right, yeah.
And this is going to be a little bit of a special episode. It's a little bit less engineering and more, I suppose, urban planning.
Okay, but ingenuity?
That's right. Yeah, a little bit of kind of avant-garde, I suppose.
That's one word for it.
So it's going to be a little bit less about the design and construction of engineering and more the organic development of city centers.
Okay.
And just the post rigid urban planning. And I always like to think of urban planning as kind of a cousin of engineering.
Okay, like a soft science?
I wouldn't call it a soft science, but it's related to engineering in the same way that architecture could be related to engineering.
Okay.
Okay, so the Kowloon Walled City, it was a very dense settlement in a small section of Hong Kong. And for those of you who don't really know about, you know, Hong Kong and its political structure, like I'll get into it a little bit more during the history. But basically, Hong Kong was a British colony that was originally Chinese, but came under British rule. And this small walled area was disputed as to whose jurisdiction it was.
Okay.
So originally, it was a Chinese kind of administrative center.
Almost like an enclave?
Yeah, exactly. So it was a Chinese territory within a British island within a Chinese country.
Okay.
And what happened was it was technically Chinese, but because China didn't actually have any real power there, basically people moved in and claimed it as a free anarchist state.
Interesting.
Within Hong Kong, and it developed very organically. There was a population boom and people just kept building it up and up and up. And in a way, I suppose it was a slum. You could look at it that way.
Yeah. I'm going to get ahead of this a little bit. So we went to, there's like kind of a monument and a few remnants of the city that are still standing. We went there. It definitely kind of had like a slummish vibe.
At the same time, I think you have to remember that in that period, which was in the 60s, really, 60s, 70s in Hong Kong, yes, Hong Kong was building quite economically as a power, but it was still poor, you know, like before the ports really got going, before all the banking industry and the financial industry moved into Hong Kong, before all the trade really make it the rich island that it was, all of Hong Kong was kind of poor.
Okay.
So it definitely kind of became a slum after the rapid development. And I'll get into more of why that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a strong sense of community in there. And I think there's multiple schools of thought when it comes to urban planning. There's the idea that, you know, you want a lot of government intervention, zoning laws, telling people like this area is for commercial activity, this area is for residential, like very strict laws and bylaws about what a community should be.
Yeah.
And then there's, of course, the opposite urban planning school of thought where a community should be a community that serves its community. Like it should grow organically and it should serve the people and not be regulated. Right. Okay. So there's that school of thought as well, which is valid, totally valid in a major movement in the 70s and 80s. So I think this is kind of an interesting study.
Yeah.
As to what, you know, that school of thought like completely acted out in reality.
right.
might look like.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I'm super interested to see where this one goes.
Okay. The Kalinwald city was 2.6 hectares. So that's roughly the size of 3.5 soccer fields.
Okay.
That was the most metric measurement I could think of. I tried to look up what like a football field is, and it's like debated depending on, I guess, how many yards and what kind of football you were playing. Like, leave it to an imperial system to be completely arbitrary, right?
Yeah.
So roughly 4 football fields. I'm not super sure on that figure.
Yeah. Four, like maybe 4 American football fields.
Possibly. Yeah.
And then like, I don't know, 12 Canadian football fields. What's the...
I don't know. I couldn't get a definitive number for football fields.
Yeah.
So sports fans out there, don't correct me. Like, I don't care.
do correct her. Leave us a comment on your social media platform of choice. But don't leave us a bad review.
So 3.5 soccer fields.
Okay.
And within this 3.5 soccer fields, at its peak, it had up to 50,000 people living in it.
So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put this in terms of density. Density-wise, this is between 1 to 2 million people per square kilometer.
That's mental.
And I'll put this in context for you. Manhattan has 27,000 people per square kilometer. Okay. Yeah. Manila is the densest city in the world, and it has 41,000 people per square kilometer. So we're talking about many orders of magnitude.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
So 1 to 2 million people per square kilometer is very dense.
Yeah. And like people lived there. This isn't like a gathering place. Like this is like people lived there, right?
Oh yeah. And it wasn't even only residential. So like on top of those people living there, there were factories, there were businesses, there were both commercial and industrial activity. It was a self-contained community. It had schools. You know, it had daycares. It had its own sort of public services. So on top of that density, you had all of this.
That's crazy.
So originally, Kalinwald City was a Chinese fort. So there were sort of military structures, kind of gates, a main administrative building that sat on this footprint. And originally it was fairly flat, right? It was maybe one story, kind of small buildings. And it went up very quickly as the population boomed.
Okay.
But at the same time, it couldn't go up too high because it was very close to the airport, the Kai Tak Airport. So this is the old airport in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
There are a lot of famous photos of how airplanes had to take this weird turn on approach to the airport between buildings. Like, it kind of had to weave through these high rises to land. And it really limited like the size of aircraft that could land. It was just crazy.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you've got these buildings that are just sort of expanding upwards without any control, right? Somebody's just trying to build like a house.
So that was the only control, was it couldn't be higher than the limit for the planes.
Okay.
But it's right at the limit. Like there are photos of planes practically skimming the rooftops.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's pretty dramatic.
So the airport was about 800 meters south of the city. Right? So quite close.
Yeah, in airplane meters, that's not a lot of space for an airplane to...
Yeah.
Oh man.
So building up, Kowloon City couldn't be higher than 14 stories.
Okay.
So you've got a lot of people moving in. You've already got a footprint. It's restricted in that way. And then you've got a height restriction. So really what ended happening is it was very dense. It was very much packed in. Units were small. People were mostly on top of each other.
Wow. Okay.
So like I said, it contained residential units, commercial, industrial. There were a lot of restaurants and food shops, schools, kindergartens. There were even schools that were run by charities like the Red Cross.
Okay.
Like they were officially operating within Kowloon City. There were metal fabrication shops. There were small fabrication shops. There were a lot of unlicensed medical care.
Yeah. So like perhaps dentists?
Dentists and doctors. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've talked about self-taught engineers quite a bit on this podcast. Now imagine, just imagine going to a self-taught dentist.
That's not quite fair. A lot of dentists and doctors back then were educated overseas.
Oh, right.
And so when they came back to Hong Kong, they didn't quite get their licensing because of their educational requirements. So it's not that they didn't receive an education, it just wasn't necessarily recognized in Hong Kong.
I see. Okay, well, that is 100% less terrifying. But all the same, I mean, I feel like an unlicensed dentist is just a recipe for...
It's not something I would go to now. But I mean, they operated in Kowloon City and, you know, it was cheap. Yeah. People were poor, you know, for that price and for that demographic. I'm sure it was a surprising level of care.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So fine. So now I feel like a jerk for making a joke about that.
So there was no space that was unused. Every unit, every square meter was used for something, including the rooftop. And now we're talking about the fact that there's just no green space, right? There's no like parks in the community. So most of the kids actually played on the rooftops.
Okay.
Daycares were run on the rooftops. Like the buildings were so close together, you could basically walk across.
Yeah.
And there are some fabulous pictures of people using the roof as lounge space.
Oh, man.
It was a Chinese territory. And the common misconception is that it had no police jurisdiction. And that's not necessarily true. It wasn't regulated. The word that I kept coming up with in my research was not illegal, but extra legal.
Extra legal. Okay. So like operating outside of the law, not breaking the law, just operating outside of, interesting. I've never had to consider that distinction before.
Yeah. So all these unlicensed medical care, all of this unofficial services being run, wells that were being dug for water that weren't licensed or you know, registered with the city and things like that. Not illegal, just extra legal. Like they weren't necessarily provided by the government.
Yeah. And so nowadays, we assume most countries are going to have regulations that would make these things illegal. But then and there was just people making do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So unless there was some major crime that went on, I wouldn't say the police turned a blind eye to it, but they just weren't really going to regulate things.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening was that Kowloon City became this kind of anarchy run by the local triads, lawless kind of community.
Right.
It's kind of like the mafia in the States, right? Like, yes, they're organized crime, but at the same time, they also like provided services that weren't being provided by the government. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways where the government failed to provide safe water, for example, or electricity, like a lot of the local triad groups actually stepped in and provided services.
Right. Okay. So yeah, and I know like Pablo Escobar did the same thing in Medellin and that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I watched that show on Netflix.
And they would be the ones that would negotiate with the police and with the government, like whenever the government had to come in, right? Like if they were investigating a murder investigation, like something they actually had to follow up with and prosecute, they would first go to the triads and figure out a way to make sure they can enter the city safely.
Oh, wow.
So in a way, they represented the city, but they also took care of their citizens.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Anti-hero sort of a thing happening here.
Yeah, it was very scrappy. There was a lot of petty crime for sure.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of accounts of, you know, getting robbed, right? Mm-hmm. Getting robbed in the city. They will take anything. They'll take $20. They'll take you know, 20 Hong Kong dollars, which is worth like $4 Canadian. Yeah. So, you know, that is the nature of Kowloon Walled City.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I'm not sure, but it was demolished in 1993.
Yeah.
It lasted from about kind of the 60s was when it really boomed. It started kind of before World War II, and it was demolished in 1993. It's now a park. There's an exhibit that you can go and visit where they've kept some of the original heritage buildings and really interesting dioramas and photographs and videos from the time where you can kind of see what it was like.
Yeah. Some fairly comprehensive maps
Yeah. And I looked into trying to post some of those diagrams and maps on our social media, but it's so dense, the illustration, that like it won't make any sense.
Yeah. Like when you're physically there and looking at it, it's big. It's like a big map, and you still have to like lean in and squint because it's yeah.
Yeah.
There's just so much. Like, oh, what's that joke? It's just like, it's not an apartment. This is a compartment.
Yeah, yeah. It was very much like an anthill, you know?
Yeah.
It's very maze-like as well.
Yeah, imagine stacking, what, like 5,000 food trucks on top of each other?
Well, it wouldn't be 5,000 because they had a maximum limit. 14 stories was as high as they could go.
Right.
But they just, it was Lego.
Yeah.
You know, imagine how many Lego blocks you would take to build up 14 and then, you know, however many blocks you would need to represent 3.5 soccer fields. Like each of those Lego blocks would be right on top of each other, right beside each other. And that was your units.
Yeah. Just crazy.
I hope this is a good description of what this is. I feel like this is one of those projects that's hard to visualize and not super well known. So
yeah, I mean, definitely recommend. So we'll post, you know, what pictures we can. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely recommend do a little bit of Google work just outside, just to try and get like the scope, because I can almost guarantee that if you've never had anything to do with the Kowloon Walled City, you're imagining it much like bigger and more spread out than it really is.
Yeah, yeah. It is not. It is compact.
Yeah.
Let me get into a little bit of the history and how this was developed.
Okay.
So Hong Kong was under British control between 1841 and 1997. And I'm going back a little bit further to explain how this happened. Okay. Yeah. So bear with me. Before this time in the 1800s, Britain and China had a very strong trade relationship. But the demand for Chinese goods far outweighed the demand for British goods. And so there was a trade deficit.
Okay.
And Britain was not too happy about this because they were buying a lot of Chinese goods and not really exporting very much of their own stuff.
Yeah.
And to remedy that, Britain started growing opium and smuggling it into China.
Oh, yikes.
And by getting the Chinese population hooked on opium, they started the Opium War.
Yeah.
So this was their way of trying to balance the trade deficit by having illicit goods.
Okay. That is, yeah, because that's garbage.
So I know a lot of times we talk about how Hong Kong was under British rule, and it's not often highlighted like how that came to be. So I just want to make sure that that history is covered.
Yeah.
It wasn't just some invasion. Like it was a very underhanded economic move.
Yeah. And it definitely wasn't like an agreement.
No.
It wasn't a handshake thing. Like it was a dirty war.
It was. And I think context is important because the Chinese Empire at the time was strong. It had great goods and it was on its way up.
Yeah.
And because of this war, so when Britain started smuggling opium in, China tried to stop the import of opium because they knew it wasn't good for their people.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain sent their military forces to push through the opium.
Oh, man.
And of course, when we talk about military power, like China was just overrun and they lost the Opium War. And they lost so drastically that Hong Kong and Macau were basically leased to the British Empire.
Yeah.
And so they were able to have these two very important ports in Southeast Asia, which at the time was really important for trade, right? Like they needed these ports for access, for shipping. It was close to India. It was just a good stopping point.
Sure.
This is how Hong Kong became a British colony. It's a messy and it's a sad history. And I think we need to recognize that.
Yeah.
So Kowloon was a fort within Hong Kong and it remained, quote unquote, under Chinese government. But kind of around World War II, it became an abandoned administrative center. So there weren't that many Chinese people living in there, mostly squatters.
Okay.
And it wasn't a functioning administrative center. It was sometimes visited by British tourists as Chinatown, which I find super offensive that like they came in, took the land, and then visited this enclave as Chinatown. Like it's just so condescending to me.
Yeah. I mean, we are talking about Britain.
I know I'm being like very emotional about this episode, so I own that. Okay, World War II, the Japanese actually invaded Hong Kong, demolished the city walls, and used the stones from the city to build Kai Tak Airport. So that is actually how Kai Tak Airport started.
Wow.
So it was under Japanese rule during World War II.
Yeah.
After World War II, the Japanese retreated, and Britain reclaimed Hong Kong, and China intended to reclaim Kowloon. They wanted to build back the fact that they had this land in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And so refugees from China just flooded the city. There were over 2,000 squatters by 1947.
Oh, wow.
And Britain failed to drive out any of the squatters. Like they just couldn't get rid of them.
Yeah.
So after 1948, they adopted a hands-off, quote-unquote, policy.
Oh, lovely.
So it was lawless, it was serviceless, and this set it up for just what it would ultimately become.
Wow. So not impressed with the British. Like, I think it's good that they didn't, you know, actively kick people out, but at the same time, just being like, all right, well, you want to live here, then no services.
It's not super responsible.
Yeah.
There was no police authority until 1959, at which point a murder occurred in the city. And by then, like the city was already filled with crime and criminals and gangs and its kind of own law. And in the 1950s, the triads and other gangs had established brothels, gambling dens, opium dens. Like it was extra legal.
Yeah. And I imagine a lot of that stuff would have been actively illegal at the time.
Well, but this is the thing is if the government decides to have a hands-off policy, not providing services, but also not enforcing the law, is it really illegal? Because then I think that's how they made the argument that it's extra legal. Like,
yeah,
if your stance is not to, you know, regulate or enforce any law there, then it is up to them to have their own laws.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
So even after 1959, when the police were decided to have jurisdiction over the city, they still were too afraid to go in unless they were in large groups having, you know, negotiated all the entry agreements and access with the triads.
Yeah.
They didn't just barge in.
Interesting.
In the 1960s, there was massive construction. All of the one-story buildings were basically demolished and modular units were built up on top of each other.
Yeah.
And this was, of course, unregulated. Like this did not follow a single building code. These were mostly, I'm going to use this term a lot, and I want you to keep in mind what this means, private contractors.
Okay.
That would build these units, okay?
Yeah.
So private contractors, we're talking about like not even self-taught engineers. We're talking self-taught something or another.
Yeah. Somebody with a hammer and a couple of nails in a lot of cases. Although, again, I mean, there are probably people that were quite good.
Sure. I mean, the thing did not fall down.
Oh, yeah. That's true. We got to give them some credit because you and I can't even build a table that stands up.
But the buildings did lean on each other to some extent.
Yeah.
So as a mass.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of buildings leaning on each other. You only need one of those buildings to stand up.
So it didn't observe building codes. It didn't have enough clearances, for example, for emergency exits. It was a fire hazard. It was a health hazard. It was crazy. So I want to paint you a picture of how close these buildings were together. In broad daylight, the alleyways would be dark.
Oof.
And it would be dripping because there would be AC units on top of each other. There'd be leaky water pipes that have been like slapped together by private contractors, you know, above these buildings, kind of like crossing each other, maybe from windows, maybe just who knows, right?
Yeah.
And so the way that you would traverse the Kowloon city is with an umbrella and a flashlight.
Because
that's how you would get through the alleys. And it wouldn't be a grid, right? Because that would be too easy. There would be weird turns. There were weird levels. You know, the whole site sloped very steeply from one side to the other. So you didn't have like a level ground to play with. You'd be moving up and down. Somehow you would go from the first floor to the fourth floor.
Oh, geez. So you've got to kind of memorize. And I imagine that back then, people weren't too interested in like mapping out.
No, because anyone who would were too afraid to go in.
Yeah.
It's all organic. You know, if you grew up in the city, you knew your stuff.
Right. And if you ask for directions, then you might get robbed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At some point, charities and NGOs started entering, providing medical and educational services. By 1984, both China and Britain had lost control over the city. The crime rates were just intolerable. And the problems from the Kowloon walled city were spilling out to the rest of Hong Kong.
Okay.
Both the Chinese and the British government said, we can't have this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, this is not self-contained anymore. It's just bad press. There were a lot of fires that had happened in squatter units that were similar to Kowloon walled city.
Right.
And it was because of overdensity, overpopulation, and it was just too difficult to manage.
Yeah.
So 1987, it was announced for demolition. There was a huge amount of compensation for the residents for them to be able to relocate. Hong Kong housing prices are absurd today, but they weren't really much better back then.
Yeah.
Right. So the government issued $2.7 billion in compensation for 33,000 residents, which sounds like a lot of money. But if you calculate it out, it was $16,000 Canadian per resident.
Okay. Yeah.
That's not a lot of money.
No. And sorry, 16,000 back then or 16,000 adjusted for today?
Today.
Oh, yeah. That's not a lot.
No. And before it was demolished, you know, there was a recognition that this was a very unique and heritage site. And so a team of Japanese architects, planners, engineers went in to try to map and preserve what they could of the walled city. And that's the only reason why we even have accurate mapping today is because of the work that they did before demolishing it. And ultimately, it was demolished in 1993, 1994.
Well, there you go.
A little bit of our history.
Yeah, the end of an era.
It is. So there's the history of things. I know it doesn't sound like there'd be a lot of science and innovation, but I will get into that next. All right, let's get into the engineering things.
Okay. And this is like engineering kind of in quotes?
Well, no. Let's start with the actual services.
Okay.
Electricity. Okay.
Oh, dear.
For the most part, the Hong Kong government or the British government didn't want to provide any type of service to the city because they didn't want to encourage any more settlement. They basically wanted to make it as uncomfortable as possible.
Yeah.
So people stopped moving into it.
Okay. Logical, but crappy.
Crappy. But at some point they realized that they couldn't not supply electricity because what ended up happening was that in a lot of squatter settlements, people were using kerosene lamps and stoves.
Okay.
And causing major fires.
Oh, yeah. That's terrible.
Yeah. So in the Sekimei squatter settlement, there was a fire in 1953. It left over 50,000 people homeless.
Wow. Okay, that's a huge, huge, that's insane.
Yeah.
From one fire.
Yes.
Well, probably turned into many, many fires, but still.
Because it was squatters.
Yeah, one blaze.
And there was no building codes that people were abiding to, and it was incredibly dense. Fire spread very quickly.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got to provide electricity. And I don't know if you know this, but electricity can start fires too. So yes, you've got to supply electricity in such a way that people actually use it properly.
Yes.
Oof.
So how to provide electricity is a big question. The China Light and Power is the company that basically supplied electricity.
Yeah.
But the demand was always greater than the supply.
Right.
And there's just the basic need for like installing infrastructure. Like, where were these cables going to go? It's not like you're building this room to run cables through.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of these places probably didn't even have like two-ply walls.
No. And buildings were sometimes touching each other. So, you know, where were you going to run these? And even through the alleys, as they were kind of like going from building to building, they tried to excavate to bury the cables.
Okay.
But they ran into rock, right? Because some of the pathways were laid by rock or brick or stone. Like, it just, they couldn't bury it. So yeah, part of what they did was they actually raised the elevation of some of the alleys.
Okay.
And buried them that way.
Wow.
But they also found just new ways of like running cables. They mounted them to the walls. They mounted them to the ceilings. Mm-hmm. There are some crazy pictures of just like junction boxes and wiring. Just yeah, this like spaghetti of things.
Oh, man.
Perfectly out in the open, right? Like, yeah, right at eye level. You could touch it. You could definitely yeah, electrocute yourself. Right? Pretty crazy. But even just the act of trying to figure out how to install it. So there was this great account of this engineer at the time who was in charge of laying down the wires for Kowloon City.
Yeah.
And they were too scared to go into the city to survey what it was, you know? So he talked about how he went in dressed in like plain clothes and not business clothes or anything. He didn't go in with drawings. Like, for the first few days, a bunch of them just went in to like acclimatize themselves to yeah, the environment so that they could get like a rough lay of the land. And then after a while, they got used to it. They knew who to talk to like get some protection. And then mm-hmm, they started surveying the grounds.
Wow.
But it was difficult, right? Because some of the buildings also had to have connections that ran through people's properties because you couldn't run them adjacent, right? Like, there weren't enough hallways or like, you know, crawl space mm-hmm, to put cables in. And so it had to go through people's properties. And of course, there's a negotiation. So it's difficult. Like, these are rough parts of town.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And then, of course, not just that, they had to build new substations and transformers within the city so that the electricity could actually be distributed, mm-hmm, right? So they had to negotiate for land within this very tight space mm-hmm, to build new transformers.
Oh, man.
And a lot of power theft actually occurred. So people would tap into existing cables yeah, and make new connections. And I mean, obviously very dangerous.
Yeah.
Private contractors.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of inevitable based on everything else that we've heard about this city.
Yeah. And yeah, they didn't do anything about it, right? Because yeah, what they supplied was what they supplied. Like, what the transformers could handle and the substations could supply was what the city got. So like, if you're stealing from it, you're just stealing from each other.
Oh yeah, fair enough.
Right? It was metered, but at the same time, like,
yeah, it was metered and then you just hack in after the meter kind yeah, of a thing, right? Yeah.
So electricity did have some.
Cool.
Potable water.
Okay.
Once again, general reluctance to supply water in the city. Didn't want to make it too habitable.
Yeah. But then cholera.
Yes. Yeah. So there was quite a bit of difficulty in laying down a pipe network. It yeah, just wasn't going to happen.
No, of course not.
definitely wasn't going to happen by the government.
Yeah.
So what they did was just supply standpipes. These would be networks that have kind of a pump.
Okay.
So that you could draw water from the system outside of the city. So you had to like get down to the ground floor, go outside of the city. There would be four standpipes at street level surrounding the city that you could get water from.
Okay.
Carried up by buckets.
Nice.
And water delivery service was actually a major industry in the city.
Oh, I believe it. Here's the other thing too, is that, okay, you think, yeah, a bucket of water, but then how far is that going to get you? Right? Bucket of water isn't going to get you that much. And any reasonable amount of water is going to be insanely heavy.
Yeah.
Right?
And you could go up as far as 14 floors, right? Like, so you got to carry it in through these like narrow alleyways, go up the floors. It's intense.
Yeah.
And people need water for lots of reasons. Mm-hmm. Not just for drinking, but for washing, for cooking. Yeah. All sorts. By 1987, there were 8 standpipes supplying 35,000 residents and factories.
Oh, wow.
Some water mains were supplied to recognized charities within the city, but like they were pretty rare.
Yeah.
So local suppliers or private contractors and the triads basically started installing wells or tapping illegally into the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, extra legal. Okay.
Oh, man.
Not illegal, extra legal.
Yeah.
There were always wells in the city from like way back when it was a fort, but they had mostly dried up. So new wells had to go down 100 meters below the surface.
Holy.
Right. Pretty insane. And even by then, that water was murky. It had leaching from the industry that was going on above.
Yeah.
It was groundwater from an urban center.
Yeah, you don't want that.
You can't drink that water. That water was only good for like washing your floors and flushing the toilet. That's Ugh. It.
Yeah.
So what the suppliers and the triads did was they would have these wells, they would pump them up to a storage tank on the roof and then have pipes coming down from the roof to supply water to each unit.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's how it was done. And that's why like the sky was always leaking when you're in the alleyways.
Oh man. Well, I mean, at least if the water coming, yeah, no, that's unpleasant. So much moisture.
Yeah. Kind of gross, but you know, people may do.
Yeah.
Right. There were a lot of pretty interesting and innovative solutions being built by people out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to admire that.
Yeah. The mother of invention, as they say.
Sanitary sewers was actually the only thing that was provided because the government knew that if they didn't provide sanitary sewers, then the problems would spread outside of the city. Like that's not a self-contained thing.
Yeah.
So they did pick up night soils. They did pick up garbage every day. Still wasn't super clean.
No.
I wouldn't call it clean.
Well, I don't see how they could possibly have kept it clean.
But it was a contained issue.
Yeah, I can't even imagine with that level of density,
mm-hmm.
even if the government was just like all in and they're just like, we've got to keep this place clean.
It just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just can't.
There's a yamen, which is this like administrative original heritage building from the fort days that was repurposed as a community center. And it was never torn down and rebuilt because that was really like Chinese government building, right? Like they just didn't dare touch it. And it was fine inside, but basically everyone just like, it was the only low-lying thing in the middle of this dense development, and people just dumped their garbage on top.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was almost like Victorian era. People just like threw things out of their building.
Yeah.
Onto this big heaping mess.
So yeah, bring an umbrella.
Bring an umbrella. Yeah. Next, I want to talk about some basic tenets of urban planning. So Jane Jacobs, have you ever heard of Jane Jacobs?
I have. You have her book.
And
you told me a little bit about it years and years ago.
She's kind of like the patron saint of urban planning. Okay. So keep in mind that before this, and she wrote this book in 1961, before 1961, urban planning was very much a rigid, idealistic, male-dominated industry.
Sure.
You think about Paris and how it's kind of built like a spoke and hub.
Yeah. So it's a small circle and then some roads leading out to a bigger circle and then some roads leading out to a bigger circle.
That was intentional. That was very like rigid urban planning.
Okay.
That they did. You think about even New York, Manhattan, right? Central Park being a major green space and having urban development built around it. Like that was also a early urban planning theory.
Okay.
And so there are all these cities, like major cities around the world that was planned, heavily planned, right? Sometimes to the point where existing communities were being demolished, gentrified.
Yeah.
In favor of these idealistic communities.
Okay. And we still have that, I mean, going on.
Yeah. So one of the things that Jane Jacobs really fought against, and keep in mind that she was not a trained urban planner. She was a journalist.
Oh, nice.
So she wrote this book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and it was groundbreaking. Jane Jacobs lived in Greenwich Village.
Okay.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
At a time when it was being gentrified, at a time when, you know, the normal communities were being changed.
Yeah.
And the organic life of things was at risk. So she wrote this in defense of a community that served people, a community that served people and not cars. Like she was the first to be like, we got to stop building these major thoroughways and major avenues with fast moving cars, because that's not a livable place for pedestrians, for families.
Mm-hmm.
She promoted diversity in a community. She promoted walkable neighborhoods. She believed that having more people out on the streets actually increased safety because people are looking out for each other. You've got neighbors watching each other. Kids were actually encouraged to play on the streets because having gated neighborhoods, the privacy actually reduces the safety. Whereas when everyone knew the neighborhood kids, this idea that everyone's watching each other, it's the village raising the children.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a very nice theory.
Yeah, and I think it's something that is very commonplace that we kind of take for granted now. You know, this idea of walkable neighborhoods, that we should build walkable neighborhoods, that we should build for pedestrians and cycling and diversity and all of that, you know, mixed use communities. This all came from Jane Jacobs.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Although I do find it somewhat frustrating that I feel like almost like people are moving away from it, you know?
How do you mean?
Well, we live in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And what do people complain about in Toronto more than anything else in the whole world?
TTC.
Oh, after that, traffic.
You're going to complain about one or the other.
No,
yeah.
I know, but it's like traffic, you know? And so there's like a push and, you know, our current government is very car friendly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's still a very traditional way of thinking, but like there's a lot of evidence that supports the fact that to reduce congestion and to solve the congestion problem is not to build bigger roads, because all that happens is you encourage more cars on the street, right? The solution is actually providing options for alternatives, having mass transport. You're going to always transport more people with public transit than you would with single vehicles.
Right.
And so she really laid the foundation for this type of work and this idea that we should have livable neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
She promoted public spaces, parks, sidewalks, fundamentally believed in the organic growth of a city. She was very much against zoning. She was against top-down planning, restrictions imposed by the government. She was very politically active. And after she spent time in Greenwich Village, she actually moved to Toronto and lobbied very much against some of the major highways that we would have seen. So I don't know if you know about this, but the Spadina Expressway was a thing.
Oh, lovely.
That would have turned Spadina, which is like a very diverse street, I suppose, like dense, urban, mixed use, like a very vibrant part of town into just like a highway.
Yeah, that would have been absolute garbage.
And she defended the rights for people to actually develop there and stay there instead of having a highway through their neighborhood. Yeah. So she was just very fundamental in this idea of a community-based urban planning approach.
Cool. Thank you, Jane Jacobs.
Now, it's interesting, and I bring this up because Kalumwald City is basically the epitome of what she idealized, right? Very much a as-needed basis.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking Jane Jacobs. I think she's fundamental in things. I just think that this is that theory pushed to the extreme.
Yeah. I mean, this is pushed way farther than I think Jane Jacobs ever would have
intended. Of course.
Yeah.
At the same time, it did prove her point, right? It was a self-contained community. It provided its own services. It provided its own laws that were extra legal, right? Not illegal. Kids knew each other and played together all on the rooftop, surrounded by people that they knew, surrounded by a community that would protect them.
Yeah. That is true. And, you know, everything that we've discussed so far, too, on the one hand, people were afraid to go in to the city. On the other hand, people in the city weren't afraid of being in the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that really does speak volumes. You know, you sort of take care of your own. And
you can extrapolate that example to a lot of like urban centers in the States, too, right? Like you look at the Bronx, you look at some of the rougher neighborhoods, like it's rough to an outsider. And I'm sure it's rough to the locals too, but like in a way they understand the system, like how to operate in that environment.
Right.
I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, you look into these communities and it's going to be a tighter community with more interpersonal interactions than you would expect in the suburb, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting like dynamic of how this played out. And that's kind of all I have for the sciencey bits of things.
Okay.
Impacts today. As I mentioned, it's been demolished. So yeah,
it's gone.
There is a park that's been rebuilt over the space and it's beautiful. It's got some of the heritage buildings, lots of photos, lots of videos of what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I highly encourage you visiting this website called City of Darkness. Basically, two photographers, Greg Girard and Ian Lambot, went in and documented a lot of really great photographs of what life was like in the Walled City.
Okay.
And it really gives like a sense of this community. Like it was very unique.
Cool.
So I think that's really worthwhile to look into. And I'm going to do a little bit of a diversion of what I think about Kalumwald City in terms of its relevance to today.
Yeah.
A minute to talk about the parallel between Kalumwald City and the situation in Hong Kong right now. It's no coincidence that I've chosen to do this episode at this time when there's a lot of political turmoil in Hong Kong. Remember that the Kalumwald City and the nature of Hong Kong grew from colonial oppression.
Yeah.
I think Hong Kongers are very quick to forget this. Right. We're very quick to adopt this British mentality that we're somehow better than mainland Chinese people. But I don't want to turn this into a sociology podcast, but I just want to point out that like we can pretend to be better and raise our noses at China. But like the Brits never viewed us as equals. You know, we were never citizens. We never got like full equality. We were kind of a stepping stone.
Yeah.
Hong Kong grew economically because it served Britain, not because it served China.
Okay.
Right? So what this resulted in is a culture that's uniquely different from China. And I think that's fine. I personally think it's just time that we stop letting our uniqueness divide us from being Chinese. Right? So I was born in Hong Kong. I was raised partly in Hong Kong. I grew up with all the classist, racist, like internalized racism that Hong Kongers have.
Yeah.
Right? It came from my parents. It came from my family. I was surrounded by it. And it's taken me a lot of self-reflection and historical context to come to the conclusion that I'm proud to be Chinese. And it doesn't mean that I support everything the Chinese government is doing. I'm just in favor of a united and also free democratic China. I'm not separating myself from being Chinese anymore. I think it's futile. Because if you ask most people from Hong Kong, they'll be able to tell you which part of China their grandparents came from. Like, our link to mainland is not that far back. And in the same way that the Kowloon Walled City was unique in its own right, playing by its own rule, it would be divisive to say it wasn't part of Hong Kong.
Sure.
So I think what I'm saying is we can be unique without like denying ourselves our heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I think that's where we find reconciliation. Moving forward between Hong Kong and China, we need to stop antagonizing each other. It's just damage that's still resonating from colonialism. And we've been separated for so long. We should build a future together, reunited. And the good fight that Hong Kongers are fighting now for freedom and democracy, I think it's a fight that should extend to all Chinese people.
Okay.
It's very pie in the sky. I get that. But at the same time, like, I think this is a good parable, right?
Yeah.
The city.
Yeah, I can see that.
The enclave being reclaimed as part of Hong Kong, this unique history that we recognize and reminisce about. I think that it's just going to be what the future of Hong Kong would look like as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. Me.
All right.
Thanks for listening to my rants about the political context of this. I hope it wasn't too off base. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe and rate on whatever podcast platform you're on. Please do this, guys. It really helps us out. Just like click the 5-star, just do it now. It really spreads the word about us. It brings us up the charts. Tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast, like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, our website. Special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound engineering this episode and all of our episodes. And remember, always measure in metric.